Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from North Carolina. Today is November 28, 2012, coming to the end of the month. Thank you to all our thousands of listeners who enjoy these free, informative broadcasts. You can be part of this educational movement. Simply tell your friends to listen into the shows, send them an email with a link, tweet it on Twitter, post the share button on Facebook, go to Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace. I'm sure you can find some place on the internet to share this information. Copy the embed code of this show for your very own website or blog. That way people stay on your website and listen at their convenience. Favorite the show, become a regular listener, and get that reminder button so you get the notice in your emails for upcoming shows. We've got lots of things going on during the week. And we're, what week are we going to have Greg back on? Do we know yet? Greg Glazer?
I believe he's going to be with us next week. I'll have to, let me double check that.
Okay, cool. So we're going to have once a month our constitutional lawyer expert coming in from California, addressing some different issues that make us think about our rights and how we get around in the United States. And I don't know if it goes beyond that, but it's very important information for anyone of any age to know about their legal rights and the Constitution. So we also recommend that if you need professional assistance, if you have any doubts about your own personal legal issues, that you contact Alan or you have an expert that he can recommend to you in your area regarding vaccinations, waivers, and exemptions. He also has an excellent e-guide that will get you started on the path to understanding and get a baseline of knowledge, and then decide from there whether you're okay to handle it on your own or you do need special assistance. Also, I'm rattling on today. We have your great website, that's pandemicresponseproject.com, and there's lots of information on there. You can also go to your local state area, NVIC Advocacy, is that .org?
.org, yes.
.org. And so you can find out what's happening in your state and connect with other people who are interested. You know, vaccinations are a huge controversy, not just in the United States, but around the world, in England, in Australia, in India. Things are going on with big business that we want to kind of – we are the balancing weight against a lot of power, a lot of money, and it's up to us to gather our strength to make a statement and keep them in check. One more thing, Alan, we've got so much stuff that's going on with Homeopathy World Community every week. I wanted to just give a heads up to folks, besides the show with Greg next Thursday at noon Eastern Time, we're also going to have on next Monday, December 3rd, the famous Miranda Castro, homeopath, will be on to talk about combination remedies and cell salts. On Wednesday, on Blog Talk Radio, we're going to have Dr. Adil Kasim back to do part two of understanding masses that occur in the breast tissue. And we also usually do a tribute to a master homeopath. And we have tons of articles on Homeopathy World Community to listen to and get onto the Facebook page, Homeopathy World Community. I think I've done just about all the plugging I'm going to do. I'm going to let you get started with some news articles.
Well, thanks, Debbie, for all the plugs and for passing the baton here both. There are just tons of things going on here. And I wanted to jump right in with an article that I got from you, I think just in the last day or so, talking about a case, and this is new to me, so I'm not even sure exactly where this case is. Do you know?
I think it's in Australia.
I'm sorry, what?
I think it's in Australia.
Okay.
I can check on that.
Yeah, it appears that the web address is a .au address, so it's probably Australia. Well, I want to talk about this in terms of law here in the U.S., because the law, of course, is different in different countries, and I really don't know that there are the same, whether or not there would be same or similar sorts of legal analysis or legal arguments available for a case if it were to be one like this in the U.S. But I think it's a really good point for a case to discuss some different concepts here. Because one of the things that I see as an attorney, and Debbie, I probably have said this in the past, I went back to school after being out of college for 17 years, and I picked law school because I was concerned about the vaccine issue. And I'm probably altruistic to a fault sometimes, that one could make that argument, but it really is a personal passion as well as my professional focus. And one of the things that I see over and over again in non-attorneys that occurs in a very reasonable way, but nonetheless it ultimately ends up being an error, is that people make assumptions about the law, they make assumptions about our rights, they sometimes interpret law in ways that ultimately are, strictly speaking, incorrect. And it takes people, in some instances, down a path that has very unfortunate consequences for them. And as I was looking at this case we'll talk about in a few moments here, I was wondering if that is something that had gone on here. So this is a case. The title says, homeopathy, is that the word regime? Is
yeah, it really should say regiment, but it does say, I think it's just the
regimen.
Way they...
Regimen. They probably
yeah,
left...
It should have been regimen, but or regime. I think they have misused the word either purposely or not purposely, or maybe they had a character space limit. I don't know why.
Okay, well, we'll say regimen if that seems the appropriate word.
It does.
For purposes of radio listeners. Homeopathy regimen is rejected as judge tells parents to immunize child. Now, we don't have to go into the details, although we will a little bit. We don't have to go into the details of the article to already understand exactly what's going on here. There was basically the judge ordered a couple to immunize their 8-year-old daughter according to government guidelines, despite that the mother had pursued a homeopathic, maybe it's an Australian use of the word because they've got it here as well, regime, pursued by the mother. The father will have to pay the cost, but they're in family court. The mother was looking for an injunction to stop the father and his partner, presumably the parents are divorced if they were ever married or certainly not living together, but they have a child. So the father wants to immunize and the mother doesn't. And I can't tell you how many times I hear that one version or another, that same story. The vast majority of the time, it's dad who wants to vaccinate and mom who doesn't. Every once in a while, I see the flip side of that. But here in the States when this comes up. And I could easily imagining someone, you know, when things are rational and reasonable, then it's easy to imagine. And anybody who investigates the vaccine controversy will quickly find an ongoing list of reasons to be concerned about standard vaccine policy, and in case in the U.S. where vaccines are legally mandated all over the place, vaccine law as well. And so one could very reasonably look to do alternatives. And Debbie, we've had some wonderful conversations, and I hope we have more, about homeoprophylaxis, which is the use of homeopathic remedies in the same or similar function as immunizations. Am I saying that correctly?
You know what? I can even plug, I am working on another program on the Health In Show with Kate Birch and Scylla Watcott, again for December, I think it's December 17th. We will have any kind of programs you're going to see on the front page banners of Homeopathy World Community. Yes, we do need to look into homeopathic protocols, and that's probably what this mom was doing, especially because Dr. Isaac Golden has been working on that for almost 20 years, and it has been proven to work. So
here's the really short summary of what for me is often a long-winded trail to get there, for better or for worse. What makes sense to us, what even may ultimately be scientifically valid and true, is not necessarily something that we have a legal right to do. And
mm-hmm.
on a common sense level, that sounds absurd, and I hope it does sound absurd, because we should be very concerned about that reality.
Explain it a little bit more. If we have a belief system, we're not allowed to pursue that.
It's not even about belief system. You can be factually correct about what is the best approach. Or in more practical terms, you can have clear, solid, sound evidence to support the choice that you choose in terms of how to take care of your children's health. And yet, you may not always have the legal right to do that. And one of the places where I see this come up in some very dramatic ways is when parents who are separated or divorced disagree about whether to vaccinate their kids, and it becomes a formal legal issue. So, for example, when I see these kind of cases in my practice, the first thing that, and let's just, most of the time, mom is the one who wants the exemption. Occasionally, I see it the other way around, but for our purposes, we'll say mom wants the exemption and dad wants to vaccinate. And commonly in these cases, again, they're all ultimately different, but it's common in these cases that the parents agreed not to vaccinate, and then they split up. And one parent, usually dad, decides to go pro-vaccine. They're going to make mom look like a fruitcake for not wanting to vaccinate, and the judge will give dad custody. And this is their, you know, part of their strategy to win their case, if that's what you want to call it. And there are some very reasonable assumptions. Well, you know, I'm a good parent. I've done my research. I've looked this up. I know what's best for my child. This is what I want to do. I don't want to vaccinate. And while that's reasonable as far as it goes, unfortunately, especially when it becomes a formal legal issue and you are in front of a judge to decide this, all of it sits in a legal framework. And so when you see that framework coming, or if you don't see it coming, when it's thrust upon you, you know, the calculus changes radically, or should, for someone who wants the best chance of achieving their end result, as it pertains to people who are against vaccination. And part of the problem here is that legally, vaccines are safe and effective. Let me give a quick example. Every state in the U.S. and every territory has mandated vaccines for school enrollment. You cannot get into school unless you do vaccines, unless you get vaccinated, for children and probably most, if not all, college students at this point as well, unless there's an exemption available and you qualify and exercise the exemption and so forth. But when state legislatures enact laws that are mandating vaccines, the legislatures are presumed to have considered whether or not the vaccines are, in fact, safe and effective, whether they're necessary, if they even get so far as to acknowledge that there's a downside to vaccines, whether there's a net benefit. And everybody knows that God has bestowed infinite wisdom on all state legislators, and so we can use that as a given to start with here. And yes, I'm being totally sarcastic when I say that, because I've been so distraught over how, trying to think of polite words here, just how, let's just say, how dysfunctional the system really is for right now. I'll leave it at that. But in any case, when a law is
dysfunctional
passed,
is the legal system?
The legal system, the legislative system.
Okay, fine.
I would say both, but I was referring specifically to the legislative system.
Okay.
And I'm happy to give, you know, specific examples to prove that
illustrate that.
But
is the legal system and the legislative system two different things?
The phrase legal system would probably include legislative system, but it would be something much broader that would include the courts and laws and so forth. When a legislature enacts a law mandating vaccines, the legislature is presumed to have considered whether the vaccines are safe and effective. And in their infinite wisdom, they decided, yes, they are, and so they passed this law. And the point is this. A law mandating vaccines in the U.S. anyway carries with it a legal presumption that the vaccines are safe and effective. Now, a presumption can be rebutted, but the starting place is that legally vaccines are safe and effective. If you go into court, whether it's a custody case or some other kind of case, and you're trying to argue in a general sense that vaccines are not safe and effective, that is an uphill battle, because the starting place is there's a legal presumption that they are safe and effective.
Uh-huh.
Now, in these custody disputes over vaccines, mom always wants to grab the first alternative doctor she can find, bring him into court, and tell the judge the truth about vaccines. And I tell you, I couldn't sympathize more with the desire to do that. I would love to educate every judge in the country about this, every family law judge in particular. Courts do not, as a general rule, they do not decide the science. Courts weigh the evidence. So for every doctor you can bring in who's going to tell the truth and talk perfectly clear and talk circles around the doctor who's testifying on the other side saying how wonderful and necessary vaccines are, I've seen this in practice. It doesn't matter what the truth is and how well it's articulated, because the courts either are going to weigh the evidence, and you've got the majority of doctors and the CDC and the state health department all supporting you should be vaccinated, you're not going to bring in enough alternative doctors to outweigh that. But even if a court is really trying to listen to this issue and see, is there something here that can rebut these presumptions? And, you know, if the judge is really going to dabble in deciding the science, which is probably something they're not really even supposed to do, as opposed to weigh the evidence. You know, there's a lot of politics, especially in local court systems. And I had a judge in one case pull the attorneys back in chambers and say, you guys settle this because my name is not going to be on a newspaper headline. And what the judge meant was, I'm not going to rule that a child not be vaccinated, because then if that child gets sick or somebody else gets sick or killed because of that child, you know, it's going to be in the newspaper headline and I'll live with guilt for the rest of my life, not be reelected or whatever. All these, you know, implications about how horrible it would be for the judge for somebody else to be allowed to take responsibility for their children, you know. So, but this is the world we live in. And so it's not enough to say what makes sense. What is my interpretation of the science? Have I done my homework? Am I being responsible? Sadly, those things are not enough. You've got to be able to come into court with a legal argument. And when you're talking about vaccines, that argument has to be one that says, here's why you can't order the child to be vaccinated, because anything less than that, the judge is going to say, well, I'm going with the CDC on this one. You know, that's 99.9% of the time, that's what's going to happen. So I don't know how the family court system works in Australia, so I'm not making any comments about this specific case that brought up the subject here. But there's a really important lesson here, because it applies in this specific context in American cases, at least. And but I think as a general proposition beyond that, that we tend to be a little too quick to make assumptions about the law and how it works and what our rights are for our own good. And so my general, I guess, point here is be careful. Be careful about making assumptions about the law. Be careful about assuming that just because you're being responsible and reasonable and doing your research, sadly, that just may not be enough. You need to go a step further and ask, how does the law work? How does the legal system work? Are there potential legal arguments? Now, there are a couple of very strong arguments that are available in many of these vaccine custody cases, and I've never seen a family law attorney who's figured this out on their own, and I'm not saying that to put them down. I'm not a legal rocket scientist. I was immersed in vaccine exemptions and waivers for a period of years before these ideas, the light bulb turned on for me.
It takes some kind of incident for you to break out of the mold of what you've been always taught is correct.
Yeah, and that's correct. And in the United States, custody, child custody, when parents, you know, have dispute over custody of their child, that's a state law issue. And every state has one version or another, as far as I know, of what they call a best interest of the child standard. The courts don't even care, you know, what mud the parents want to sling back and forth about each other. They're saying what's best for this child. And if you allow that usual custody standard to be applied to a vaccine custody dispute, the vaccines will win every time. The best interest of the child, well, that's what the health authorities say. And the health authorities, sadly, are still, as is public policy and public perception, largely controlled by the pharmaceutical industry and not by any true objective view of what do vaccines really do, both in terms of possible protection and demonstrated harm. So we're left with that. But just a real quick introduction, because when I do consultations with family law attorneys, I use a 5-page outline to go over everything that's relevant. But where people have religious exemptions, where there is religious objections, or even better, a history of religious exemption involved, you're talking about a federal First Amendment right, and federal law is a higher legal authority than state law. And the custody standards are all state law standards because custody is a state law issue. So if you go into court where the best interest of the child says vaccinate the child, but the First Amendment of the Constitution, which has your free exercise of religion right, you go in there with a federal law right, you in effect trump or supersede the custody standard because that's a state law and federal law is a higher legal authority. It doesn't necessarily instantly grant you a win, but it's a very powerful legal right.
I think in this case, I find what is difficult is the fact that the mother was never told or she didn't give consent for the child having the vaccinations given, which was done behind her back, basically, by a stepmother.
You know, and there's a similar thing that comes up also in some of these other custody cases where the parents, you know, the non-vaccinating parent is on the phone with me and they're saying, well, he agreed not to vaccinate when we were together. Doesn't that count for something? Now he's changing his mind. Well, you know, the courts are going to be focused on what's best for the child. And if dad does something that in one level is bad or wrong, but the end result is he's doing the right thing, he's vaccinating the child, the court is not going to punish dad for that.
It wasn't even dad. It was the stepmother. Who does the stepmother have a legal right?
Well, I mean, I guess the question in my mind, I mean, I don't know what the, you know, I don't have enough information to answer particular questions about, you know, an article about a case in Australia. But in general terms here in the U.S., and I would be surprised if it was radically different, you know, in other industrialized nations. But here in the U.S., the starting place is that both parents have an equal right. And so one parent cannot unilaterally make some major decision over the other parent's objection unless they go get a court order or the other parent, you know, has lost their parental rights or there's some other you know, factor involved there. If there's an emergency, of course, one parent can take the child to the doctor to get treatment or whatever. But as just sort of a general proposition, as a starting place, and absent something that says otherwise in a formal way, parents have an equal say. And so one parent can't just go out and vaccinate the child. But here's my point. And of course, the step-parent is not a parent of the child, so they have no right to do that at all, I would think.
That's what I'm getting at.
But the question is this, though. If somebody does the wrong thing but comes up with the right result...
Uh-huh, that's a good question.
That doesn't justify it. The person has still done something wrong, but you have to ask, you know, in legal terms, I have to ask, well, what is the damage there? So someone's rights have been violated, and even an abstract violation, as opposed to somebody stole $50 from me and I need my $50 back. You know, that's a very concrete, tangible harm. You can quantify it. There are recognized harms in our legal system that are not necessarily quantifiable, and violation of First Amendment rights is an example. There is at least one case I'm aware of where a school improperly rejected the parent's religious exemption, and the school system ended up paying money damages for violation of the parent's First Amendment rights. You know, that's not money out of the bank, so to speak, in terms of the violation, or that's not you hit my car with a hammer and it cost me $250 to get that fixed. You know, it's not a quantifiable harm, but it can still sometimes be compensable. But there has to be, nonetheless, an identifiable harm that you would be asking for compensation for, or some sort of...
This is the difficulty with vaccinations. On occasion, we're going to see an immediate reaction between, you know, one hour after the vaccination, some sort of a human physical response in the body, whether it's a fever or a child crying and doing screaming or in pain or swelling, whatever it might be. That might occur anywhere between 1 and 24 hours or 48 hours after the vaccination. But then again, we're going to have long-term results that are going to occur weeks to months to years afterwards from the accumulated effects, perhaps, or from that one last vaccine that is the triggering point, the straw, you know, that turns the whole thing over, and then the child either loses some function or has emotional trouble or behavioral disability, or they can't digest food anymore. And there's so many different things that can occur that is very difficult for a parent to directly attribute to the vaccination. Yet it is there. It is a factor. And this is a long-term complicated issue. So where does that fit in? I mean, we can't say this is the bullet, you know, this is it, even though we might think or suppose or believe it is the reason for the child's change.
Well, here in the U.S., we have the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, and so if there was some reaction that fell within, you know, the boundaries of that, that's your recourse. You know, I don't think if this the case we're talking about here, the father and stepmother and mother had been a case here in the U.S., and let's say the child had an immediately serious reaction and was, you know, disabled by a vaccine, and no one's questioning whether or not it was a vaccine, and it was the stepmom who went out and got the kid vaccinated. Is the stepmom liable for that? I don't think so. I think probably you have to go to the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. I imagine the stepmom would be feeling pretty strange, for lack of other words, we might say, you know, having been the one who physically went through the steps that led to that result. There'd be a lot of very difficult feelings for everyone involved, but in terms of liability, I don't know that there would be. I don't know that there wouldn't be either. I couldn't say absolutely. It's an interesting question. Could maybe the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program turn around and sue the stepmom because stepmom is the reason? I doubt it.
I'm not. I guess you know you're thinking constantly in terms of compensation and legal issues. And I'm thinking the harm that is done can never be taken back. It's like one of the old stories where, you know, you open the pillow full of feathers and they just fly out and you're never going to get them all back again. You can't undo something that is done. You can try and repair, and homeopathy and chelation and many other health modalities can help recoup the health of the person, of the child. But once you've done that act, you know, without pre-thinking about it really long and hard to determine what are going to be the effects, the long-term effects, and dealing with whatever's going to come after that, the change in the dynamics of the individual and the family, what's going to happen? You know, that's the thing that concerns me and is on my mind. Of course, you're thinking about the legal repercussions.
Well, let me tie the two together for you, Debbie, because you raise, of course, that, you know, yes, I get off in sort of a intellectual, analytical sort of mode there, and that misses, in one sense, the fundamental point here, that here's somebody whose life and the family of this person and anyone connected with this person who's suffered an injury or death from a vaccine, all these different lives are affected. Here's things that have changed. The legal system, in theory, seeks to make things right. And it has profound limitations in its ability to actually do that in literal or actual terms. If somebody steals $50 from me and the cops can find him and he hasn't spent it and they get my money back, okay, then I'm made whole again, although I still have gone through whatever trauma I've gone through to get there. You don't get made whole when you've been, well, of course, when somebody's killed, you there's no way to compensate for that at all. But in any way that could ever be significantly meaningful, no amount of money, you know, compensates for a lost child or a lost loved one. But even someone who is injured and is recovered, you don't get compensated for the anxiety and stress you go through wondering whether you ever will be able to recover the child or how much you'll be able to recover the child, for example, if you're talking about, child injuries. So the legal system just, it does the best it can, and then the parts of it that don't function properly, dysfunctional parts of it, it does even worse. But even when it functions best, you can't make people whole in every situation. You can't ever fully compensate. You can't give somebody back the time they lost. You can't give somebody back the health they lost in terms of a vaccine injury. You can maybe recover somebody over time later. So,
right.
You know, the legal system, you know, all of these things sit within a legal framework, and it's important for us to understand the legal system. But let us not lose sight of exactly what you're saying, Deborah, because it's not enough to just sort of analytically say, oh, here's where you can get some money if you're lucky. It's about, this should never happen in the first place. And what steps can we take so that these tragedies happen less and less and disappear ultimately from the face of the earth? And that's a huge question, a huge issue. There's not a quick answer, a short answer, but a big piece of the answer is what we keep talking about, the NVICAdvocacy.org, the National Vaccine Information Center's advocacy portal, because that's where we can participate in the legislative process. And that is one key piece to the how do we fix all this.
Okay, let's finish up this story just with the end of this article. Justice Bennett said the risks associated with traditional immunization did not outweigh the risks of infection. It appears to me, quote, that the efficacy of homeopathic vaccines in preventing infectious diseases has not been adequately scientifically demonstrated, she said, meaning that she took that into consideration, whether she talked about the millions of Cubans who were homeopathically vaccinated, homeoprophylactically, and the incredible results of healing, that they did not incur disease. I don't know whether this was taken into consideration. I don't know whether all the facts have been given. In any way, it says, however, the mother has lodged an appeal. The case is one of several before the courts that involve differing philosophies over childhood vaccination. The federal magistrate's court was asked to intervene between two parents disputing whether their daughter should be immunized in 2010, resulting in an order for the child to undergo the immunization program recommended by the federal health department. And that ends the story. And it's going to be interesting what happens in the future in this case, what happens in an appeal. And, well, we found out that the child was required to get the immunizations. And, you know, I pray that the child is not affected adversely.
Well, it suggests here where the judge is saying that the efficacy of homeopathic vaccines has not been adequately demonstrated. That suggests that the court is able and willing to look at that kind of information. In other words, to weigh the scientific arguments to one degree or another, to look at the science, not necessarily decide science per se. I don't know. It's interesting. We have a different legal system here. Here, vaccines are mandated, and we have a First Amendment free exercise of religion that I think other countries don't have. I don't know specifically whether or not Australia has anything equivalent to that. We have vaccines that are required and then exemption laws. I don't believe they're fundamentally mandated in Australia in the way they are here. So there's a different legal framework as well as a different legal system in which these different issues are decided. Here in the U.S., if you have an exemption involved, you have a state law right. I was saying there's a legal presumption that vaccines are safe and effective. Guess what? There's also a legal presumption that the exercise of an exemption does not pose a health risk, or not a significant health risk. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the exemption law in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the legislature is presumed to have considered whether or not the exercise of an exemption would be safe and effective, you know, a safe thing to do, and they wouldn't give us the exemption right if they deemed in their infinite wisdom that the exercise of the exemption was going to cause any undue harm. So,
I guess what scares me about this particular case, that as it could potentially present a precedent that would be basically saying all children are, you know, will have forced, just the idea of being forced to have a medical intervention. This is what frightens me, that a judge would claim, you know, make a decision in a case to do that to a child, to anybody. And that's what, you know, if it can happen to one person, then how many other people can it happen to? And that's what concerns me the most.
Well, it's a valid concern. precedent occurs on both formal and informal levels. And but, you know, we've already got that sort of framework in place. And the question is, how do we break out of that mold and move back to a more sane, objective, reasonable system? And and again, while there are many different parts and pieces to that answer, and I don't pretend to know all of them by any means, I continue to insist that a huge part of the answer has to do with legislation. That if we don't like the rights that we, first of all, we have to find out what the rights we have are. Many people misunderstand their rights. But once we're clear about that, if we don't like the rights that we have, then we need to take steps to change them. And one of the most effective ways in this arena, in my opinion anyway, is going to be legislative. And I realize, you know, I tell my clients, I say, look, you know, don't talk about vaccine adverse events in your statement of beliefs for a religious exemption, because legally vaccines are safe and effective. Just don't go there. I say it's not because I'm saying if we disagree with the mainstream views on vaccines, there's nothing we can do about it. It's about where you do it, and the place to do that, for the most part, is going to be the state legislature. If you don't like the rights you have, that's where you can change your rights. But I also recognize when I say that, that that's like handing you a glass of water and saying, now go put out a forest fire.
why is that?
You know, if you're going to go up against the pharmaceutical industry in the legislative arena, good luck. But this is the option we have in the legal system we have now. I mean, the bottom line is that there is rampant corruption, conflict of interest, control of government by industry, not just in healthcare, but in many other areas as well. And things are, policy and laws are enacted under a false pretense of this is best for everybody, when what it really is about is this is what's going to create more profit for whatever industry you're talking about on any given piece of legislation or issue. But this is the world we live in, and I'm certainly open to divine intervention, but I'm not waiting for it. You know, we've got to get to work, folks. And
okay,
each
so
one
let's,
of us has to figure out what that
some,
is.
Let's have some good news. CBS Los Angeles moving to California. Vaccination debate continues between the SoCal parents and the doctors. You know, it's controversy. You know, out west, go west, young man, they're going to be free thinkers. And people are going to want to have be independent, have their say. Los Angeles, more and more Angelanos, I don't know how you say that. I guess that's what they call themselves, have decided not to get their children vaccinated. And, you know, in the news, they have to put this word in, potentially deadly diseases. So they really hype it up and make you afraid. They say it's going to cause death, potentially deadly diseases, which has reignited an ongoing debate between parents and doctors. State law allows parents to choose whether or not they want to have their children immunized against diseases such as measles, polio, whooping cough, if it's not within their personal beliefs. So that means that they have the right religious, medical, or personal belief, personal philosophy. In a recent survey by the Associated Press, those who send their kids to private schools in California, meaning that probably they're the wealthier, well, more educated people, are more likely to opt out of vaccines than their public school counterparts. St. Aidan's School in Malibu, Westside Waldorf School in Pacific Palisades, Oak Grove School in Ojai, and Highland Hall Waldorf School in Northridge made the top of the list. More than 1,600 schools were surveyed. At Highland Hall, 84%, that's 84% of students decided to not to have vaccines completely or pick and choose which immunization shots they want. I think that's pretty cool that they could decide, well, you know, there's no smallpox, there's no polio going on in the last decade or more. Why do I really need to be immunized against it? Because, you know, when you build up these do these kinds of things, it's going to make a viral or a bacteria resist and create a newer, more potent strain. I mean, that's probably what they've figured out and learned and made a decision, just the same way that vaccinations don't work so well anymore. So this is something that I would say it's making a splash in the news. And we have to kind of look at why are these people, both parents and students, deciding to go this way?
That's awesome news, Debbie. I was not aware of that. The thought I had as you were beginning the discussion on that, you're talking about these potentially killer diseases.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, okay, let's take a minute, just a minute or two here. Don't let me get too far off track. But let's take a look at these potentially killer automobiles, because people die in automobile crashes on a regular basis. It's sad but true. When you have, you know, a couple hundred million people with cars, you know, driving every day, many of them, it's inevitable that you're going to have crashes and injured and ultimately, sadly, especially with drunk drivers and the like, some people dying in automobile crashes. So let's look at, you know, how many people die in automobile crashes compared to the number of you know, automobile drivers, perhaps. Because I'm thinking, you know, if we need to be vaccinating because of these potentially deadly diseases, we need to be actually pulling cars off the road because of these potentially deadly automobiles.
Well, you need to go to the root of the problem. It's not just the car, it's the driver. So now you have to say there's no, you know, it's going back to prohibition. You really can't drink, because if you drink and then you drive, you're going to cause an accident, which is going to cause harm to somebody else, not only yourself, the people who are the passengers in your car, or the head-on collision, the other people in the other car, or damage to the roads. You hit a pole or something and you lose the lights in the neighborhood, or you go home and you start to beat up on your family members. I mean, there are lots of things that you could be doing, or you go into a violent rage, or you start, you know, going down the path of violence in other areas of life. And so we need to stop selling alcohol now because of that. That's a conclusion.
Well, I mean, that's one thing that leads to increased number of deaths. But I was, you know, hopefully it was obvious. I was being a little bit facetious
I'm
satirical. But the point is here, if you're going to say that because sometimes people die from disease, we need to vaccinate, how many other things should we have prohibitions on in our world because they can potentially lead, you know, to injury or death? And, you know, it's an interesting control tactic to refer to things that trigger people's fear, to have people act out of fear instead of out of a more objective assessment of the topic.
Can I give you a couple little facts from this article also? According to the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health, there were 8 cases of measles in 2010 and 8 cases of measles in 2011. Okay, how many car crashes? I mean, you make a comparison. What's the priority? Pediatrician Jay Gordon doesn't think that diseases like measles will make a comeback in the United States, but believes the vaccination shots have dangerous side effects. A quote, "I think that there's a very small percentage of children who are born with a genetic predisposition to illnesses, whether it's diabetes, arthritis, or autism, and that genetic predisposition needs an environmental trigger." And he is right on target there, because environmental triggers are the cause of majority of disease today. "For some kids, the trigger might be pesticides or the chemicals in your carpet, or it may be vaccines," said Dr. Gordon. And the thing is, Governor Jerry Brown recently signed that bill, AB 2109, I'm sure we discussed it at length, which is aimed to increase immunization rates in California. So now the bill requires parents who wish to opt out in both private and public schools to provide proof that they've talked with a licensed doctor or nurse about the dangers of not vaccinating. Okay, so this means that the 84% from that school have talked with their doctor.
Well, that part may not be in effect yet, but it will become a requirement if it survives. I mean, I hope somebody challenges this, because I think this law is unconstitutional. I thought it was unconstitutional when it was still a bill. And when we heard a legal argument that I think we talked about last week or recently about the free speech violation, that it is equally a violation of free speech, not just to be prevented from saying something that you have a right to say, but also by being required to say something that you don't agree with. And that came up with the bill in Vermont. And so now Vermont is looking at their law and seeing if they need to change the statement that they're asking parents to sign accordingly. I think we could see a same or similar issue in Washington State and California with the laws passed last year in Washington and then this year in California. So I'm delighted to hear, excuse me, I'm delighted to hear that there are still people who are challenging the status quo, who are sticking to their guns, who, despite a temporary setback with a bad bill being passed, you know, there are ways to challenge these new laws that I hope will happen in Washington, California, as appears to be going on right now in Vermont. We have to put some brakes on this train, because it's not planning on stopping on its own anytime soon, if ever. But we have some ways here that we can do that. So hopefully that will happen. We'll have to watch this over time. Send me a link to that article, Debbie.
Okay, I'll do that. So do we want to go to flu shots? Don't let drug companies poison you?
There have been a couple of interesting articles recently where there have been some people, some scientists, challenging the effectiveness of flu vaccines, saying that they've been overhyped. And the flu vaccine just is coming up over and over again in the news in different ways. We just had 150 employees at TriHealth in, Cincinnati, somewhere in Ohio, where they refused to get the flu vaccine that their employer was requiring, and they all got fired. And the article I read said they may be allowed to come back, but they would first have to get the flu shot, and even then they may or may not be hired back. You know, I know, because I work with healthcare workers on a regular basis all over the country, that 150 people who got fired represents 1,500 or more who didn't want the flu shot. But most healthcare workers will not even ask for an exemption or object, because they feel like they can't put their job at risk. They're afraid they'll be fired just for asking for an exemption, whether it's granted or not. They'll be seen as a troublemaker. The hospital environment, from what I am seeing all over the country without exception, is very rigid, very militant, oppressive, and hospital administrators often bully their employees, especially on these flu shot issues. So, and I've never heard somebody, I've never talked to a healthcare worker who said, well, thank God it's not like that where I work. Never heard that. 100% consistency, pretty much, about the difficult work environment.
Right. So this is the season for flu. What can you do? We have on Homeopathy World Community bunches of kits, remedy kits. We have lots and lots of articles about influenza and homeopathic remedies that are used when you get these symptoms and you notice, you know, flu comes on very rapidly, and I have been discussing on the shows, on the Blog Talk Radio shows, how to practice homeopathy by the author of Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD. And every time I read his writings, I become inspired and motivated and educated, because he gives us laws of nature, laws of healing, how to practice homeopathy, yesterday for a half an hour I talked about how do you take a case, what are you looking for, how do you differentiate between an acute illness and a chronic illness. And yesterday we learned that if you have an acute illness, which I would consider influenza, that you're going to have pretty clear symptoms to go on. They're going to be dramatic. You're going to feel it so, it's going to be so obvious to you that either you have a pulsing headache, or you're sweating, or you're chilled and you're trembling, or you're nauseous, whatever those symptoms are, if you have body aches and pains, it's going to be so clear you're going to be able to decide what homeopathic remedy is going to be best for that type of a flu. And then he says, this is the beauty of homeopathy, once your acute symptoms dissipate and you're kind of in a really good state, because your body has discharged and been able to clear out something that has been latent in there, then you're going to be left with symptoms that are of your chronic disease nature. And you'll be able to take the case again and clear out something that your body has not been able to take care of on its own. And basically, he explained in previous sessions and previous chapters that an acute illness typically if you're strong enough, if your vital force is strong enough, you're going to be able to clear it out without any assistance over a little bit of time. You know, you know that you get a tummy ache and, you know, something happens. Maybe you had food poisoning. You get better, and then you're left with feeling a lot more energetic. But then you have a new set of symptoms, and those are the ones that a homeopath can then look up in the repertory, the symptoms, and put a good, clear picture together. So for that information, I would say go to Homeopathy World Community, take a look at the articles on influenza, and look at Miranda Castro's kits and Homeopathy World kits. We have a lot of resources here. So I hope that helps in terms of flu season.
I'm sure it will, because a lot of people need something effective they can do to either prevent or help with the flu once they get it. I wanted to jump in on a quick topic change, if I may, Debbie, here. I see we're running down to the last couple of minutes here.
Okay.
End on some good news here. Federal Congress just passed, after a 14-year struggle, a bipartisan whistleblower protection bill that will make a potentially huge difference to federal workers. According to an article on the website of the Union of Concerned Scientists, it should be especially welcomed by federal scientists. Now, the Union of Concerned Scientists did a survey of federal agency scientists just a few years ago, published on their website. You can find it real easy on the internet. It's called Voices of Federal Scientists. Highly recommend people take a look at that. It's a short report and lots of information there saying things like, when they interviewed federal agency scientists, like many of them say there are instances where they've been told to change their conclusions or their research has been ignored and policy enacted directly contrary to the research. And what seems like a no-brainer, of course, if somebody sees corruption in the workplace, if they report it, they should be protected by law, but apparently not until this bill has just gotten passed, and Obama is expected to sign it into law. And this is just terrific because it will enable people who see harm other than things like waste, fraud, and abuse in government. But this new law recognizes that a scientist who exposes the censorship of federal information that could be crucial to public health and safety, that person is now considered a whistleblower, and they will have whistleblower protections. So this could, they're saying that a scientist is just as much a whistleblower as the federal worker who exposes embezzlement or accepting bribes and that sort of thing. So this will potentially open the door for some of the corruption that goes on in the FDA and other agencies to be exposed.
And do we know who introduced this? It was Senators Akaka and Susan Collins of Maine. So is that from Hawaii and from Maine?
Yep. They were, the article says, crucial to the successful passage of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, as it's called. Anyway, this is terrific news. I'm just delighted to see something like this, and I can't believe it took 14 years. Well, I guess I can, considering the people who would have an interest in preventing something like this from coming through. But, it has yet to be seen what the impact this will have on industry and government is, but let's look for some positive changes and events because of it.
So this was actually passed. This is enacted that these scientists are now protected.
Well, the article says, and the article's from earlier this month, says that Congress has passed it, but it will not become law unless and until Obama signs it into law. But the article says he's expected to do that.
I hope so.
Well, I can't imagine him not doing that. That would look really, really bad. But, you never know until it happens. But it looks good at this point. So
I love when we have some good news to report.
Yeah, I wanted to end on a high note because there's so many dark notes that we address during this show.
Yeah, we're constantly concerned about what's happening. And okay, so we really are, you know, we're out of time for our show together, for vaccinations and your rights. But I think I'm going to continue on and do some readings from Dr. Herbert Roberts, one of my very favorite, on the art, the principles and art of cure by homeopathy. I've been reading chapter by chapter, and every time, you know, repetition is a really, really good thing, and it kind of embeds in your system the wisdom of these teachings of homeopathy, and that's why I enjoy reading it and continually learning and reminding how to practice. So I'm going to let you go. I know you're very busy, and tell people how they can contact you.
Sure. All my contact information is at vaccinerights.com, vaccinerights.com. You can call me by phone or email me, or if you're really old-fashioned, snail mail. It's all there at vaccinerights.com.
Okay. So we're looking forward to next week's show with you and Greg, and have a great weekend.
You too. Take care, everybody.
Okay. Bye-bye. And I'm going to continue to talk as Alan leaves the show and gets back to his law office. We're going to be talking today about, we've already read Chapter 7, Our Remedies and Why They Act, and explained that pretty detailed information. Then yesterday, after our session on Wednesday with Dr. Adel talking about masses in breast tissue, we talked about taking the case. How does a homeopath sit down with a new client and take in information? What is the best ethical and moral behavior on their part not to sway or be prejudiced or biased in any way when gathering information? It is a completely scientific method of taking the case. And so I'm going to just say that he said, your patient should readily reveal many of the most important things to you after sitting there for an hour or two or three if you have been tactful and have secured his confidence. Which means to me, what I tell someone when working with anyone is, it's a relationship, it's a partnership, you're both, the goal is healing. The goal is self-awareness. The goal is understanding where does the illness begin? What is the etiology? What are the triggers? What are the causes? And how can you clear those if it's something in the environment, if it is something you've been eating improperly, if it is that the fact that you're living with the moldy basement, if you just lived through a hurricane like Hurricane Sandy. People are emotionally distraught or traumatized, have a lot of grief, have a lot of loss. They may have lost loved ones or personal items or mementos or just their shelter or even employment. These are all factors that you must take into consideration, not simply doing a diagnostic and saying, you know, your EKG is such and such, your blood pressure is such and such. Those are nice to have, and it is important, but we really need to understand the person. And so Dr. Roberts says, I refer you to a wonderful questionnaire compiled by Dr. Pierre Schmidt that will assist you if you're a homeopath, if you're a MD, medical doctor, if you're a physician's assistant, a nurse, if you're a chiropractor, an acupuncturist, whatever. This questionnaire will help to secure information you desire. And if you will study this carefully, it will prove a valuable guide in directing your questioning. Directing your questioning only after the patient has finished telling you all he thought was necessary to your treatment of the case, which means that let the person speak. Let them let it all out. Let them have a cathartic experience. Let them tell their story and explain what's going on with them so that you can understand their point of view. It is well to reiterate the instruction, do not interrupt your patient while he is telling all he knows of his case, except insofar as he may require guidance
to keep him to the subject in hand. The physician's questioning comes afterward, and it is here that we must complete the picture of the case. So there's going to be blank spaces. You're going to have questions in your mind as a homeopath, as a physician. When the person gives his story and tells everything, maybe they're not telling the complete story. Maybe there's something, that little piece of information that's missing that you need to know, and you can ask all of those questions at the end of the dialogue. What are the essentials to recording, to record casing in taking a case? You need to take the general symptoms, the modalities, the sensations, and the concomitants, which are the symptoms that occur simultaneously. So, in other words, concomitant, while you're perspiring, you're trembling. While you're perspiring, you need to throw off the covers. Why should we have a written record of each case? Well, it seems pretty obvious, so that we can review the case as a complete whole for our first prescription, first of all, and secondly, for future reference, so that we may note progress. And it is important to note the progress based on previous chapter through Herring's Law, through the direction of cure. Why do we need to pay little attention to the chronic symptoms in taking an acute case? That's a good question. I mean, do we need to know something that happened in the past? Do we need to know that the person, let's say, is always desiring a certain kind of food, or has restless legs? If they've always had restless legs and now they're in an acute situation, an acute event, do the restless legs play any part in this present disease? So his answer is, we take each case as completely as possible, for when an acute seizure is present, the chronic symptoms usually retire into the background, so that we need only prescribe for the totality as presented. So it's very possible that those restless legs, that particular symptom may actually disappear during an acute situation. When do we find the chronic symptoms portrayed most clearly? And I was explaining that earlier in today's show. At the end of an acute attack, the chronic symptoms usually show themselves clearly, even more clearly than at other times. The conditions following an acute attack are not the result of the acute attack, but because nature has cleared the patient to a greater or less degree by the acute explosion, and this leaves a clear picture of the chronic condition. So you can imagine, visualize something in your mind that makes that particular principle clear to you. What can you think of? Can you think of a volcano that is constantly rumbling and then has an explosion? And then after the explosion and the dust clears, now you can really see clearly, what is this volcano about? What is this mountain about? In a plant, can you imagine the burst of energy at some part in the stage of this plant that then gives you a clear picture? What is the identity of that plant? In animals, is there something that is like an explosion of energy that afterwards gives you a clear identity picture of what that animal is? And now we're moving now to chapter number 9 of The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, written by Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD. And I want to thank you if you're a guest on listening to the show. If you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to answer them as best that I can. We're now reading chapter 9, Analysis of the Case. And this is written for homeopaths, for doctors, and helping them to become better physicians. Dr. Roberts says, in analysis of the case, the value of symptoms must be taken into consideration on several points. First, the personality, the individuality of the patient must stand out preeminently in the picture. This can be illustrated by likening the whole symptomatology to a complete picture of the whole individual, a whole personality. This embraces not only his physical characteristics, but the expression of his mental and emotional characteristics as well. And so this is very, very different from allopathy, traditional Western medicine, where we kind of look at germ warfare, we look at the physical picture through clinical diagnostic testing that we must. But how often does a doctor want to know what has happened in a person's life, what emotional reactions and responses, and how the body expresses that? Dr. Roberts says, while the generals rank the highest in evaluating the case, and generals is a special way that homeopaths look at something about the individual that pertains to the entire individual, the generals rank the highest in evaluating the case, and without generals, we cannot expect to find the similimum or the matching remedy. The mental and emotional characteristics have a high value. Since these are the true reflections of his personality, the man himself or the woman herself, because the subjective symptoms are the registration of his physical or other difficulties as expressed upon his own personality, these are also of great value. The objective symptoms are less differentiative. Yet their value lies in the fact that they cannot be distorted by the design of the patient. He little realizes that he is manifesting these objective symptoms, and therefore they picture accurately certain phases of the case. Objective symptoms, those that are seen by the careful observer, have more importance in child life than in adult life. Because through them, we see the expression of the child's disposition and desires. Therefore, many of the seemingly objective symptoms may be translated into subjective form. It is for us to interpret the symptom according to our understanding of its proper value. While they may be presented to us in child life almost entirely as objective symptoms, yet they may have their counterpart subjectively in the provings. This is kind of a complicated paragraph that he's talking about. What are objective symptoms? What is it that the careful observer can see? And he's saying that for some reason, your objective symptoms that you see are very much more important when you see them in a child than when you see them in an adult. Perhaps because a child is so innocent and honest, they can only express themselves in one way. They cannot simply give you information that is rationalized, that you give, I feel this way because I took too many vitamins, or for some, they, like an adult, can rationalize away their symptoms, but a child just expresses them outright. And now he says, in that same paragraph, yet they may have their counterpart subjectively in the provings. And the provings are the clinical trials of healthy persons who are testing a drug, testing a homeopathic remedy. And so we have to go into the documentation to see how the medicine is expressing itself and what kind of symptoms it can express to see that. Now, in taking a case, we must take into consideration the nature of the disease and its peculiar types. We must know disease accurately before we can give effective relief. Occasional cures take place without such knowledge, but it is almost by accident. That is, we must know its peculiar manifestations in each individual case, taking into consideration its complete symptom totality. The complete knowledge of the case is associated with another important item. We must know and possess the means by which we are able to relieve. Without this latter knowledge, any knowledge of symptoms is to no avail. So he says, every so often you're going to be able to get relief to a case, to an illness, simply by accident. But he's saying it's important for the doctor, for the homeopath, to know about the nature of the disease and the different kinds of qualities of the disease and types of diseases and how they're expressed, what kind of symptoms you're apt to see in the progression of the disease. And with this knowledge, you'll be able to find the similimum. It's not basically by accident that you're curing the case, but you really have to have that information and knowledge. There has been a great knowledge of disease attained from investigators from the earliest times. Methods have been improved whereby diagnostic symptoms have been correlated, and all praise is due to these investigators along this line. The only difficulty is that diseases have come to be treated by names of the diseases instead of by individual symptoms. The disease has been treated rather than the patient. So this is where we come to that famous quote, treat the patient, not the disease, for homeopaths. So just because you take a swab of a person's throat and determine that they have strep throat, you don't just throw an antibiotic at them, because that is going to be like a broad spectrum thing. It's going to wipe out everything in the body, even the good stuff that could be healing for the person, that could elicit a curative response from the innate immune system. Why would you want to destroy the immune system with an antibiotic? Rather, understand the disease, the type of disease, the qualities that the disease elicits, and that knowledge, and then understand what is the patient, what symptoms does the patient have, because that same disease, that same virus or bacteria or whatever germ it is, in 10 people, they may not have all the same symptoms from the same virus or the same bacteria or from that strep. They might have different symptoms elicited because of the individuality of the patient's immune system, their vital force. So Dr. Roberts says, it is only upon the totality of the symptoms that we can base our prescription. And so we require many individual symptoms as showing the characteristics and personality of the patient. So that's why he's saying take the totality of the case. Take all the symptoms in. Don't limit yourself to only having a sore throat and difficulty swallowing and swollen glands and the diagnostic swab to say this is strep. Understand the patient more. What kind of emotional state are they in? What kind of intellectual state, mental state, spiritual state besides the physical? So he says, so these diagnostic symptoms are of very little use to the homeopathic prescriber in selecting the remedy. In fact, the similimum is practically never found among the diagnostic symptoms. In other words, saying, okay, we've taken this diagnostic test. We understand that the person has strep. We've seen it under the microscope. But what does this tell a homeopath? In considering the diagnostic symptoms in the selection of the remedy, its only practical value is in excluding those remedies from consideration which do not correspond to the genius of the disease, but act chiefly on other parts of the organism. Thus, in our historical documentation of 250 years of homeopathy, we have a list of, I don't know whether it's 100 remedies or whatever number it is of remedies that have been curative in the disease of strep throat. This is one way of narrowing down the field amongst thousands of homeopathic remedies that we know the validity, and it has been affirmed that these 100 remedies have been effective in this condition. So now you need to go further and look at the patient. So here Dr. Roberts says, if we allow ourselves to become influenced by a diagnosis in making our remedy selection, we are very apt to become confused and fail to help our patient. We may be faced with a diagnosis of some grave condition, such as some form of deep abscess, a grave pneumonia condition, an internal hemorrhage, or any one of a host of conditions. Selection of the remedy on the basis of the diagnosis may and probably will fail completely. However, the symptoms of the patient are an infallible guide, and the more serious the condition, the clearer cut are the indications for the remedy. If we allow ourselves to be guided by these symptoms, we shall probably save the patient, even though the remedy selected on the basis of the symptom totality may never have been used under like diagnostic conditions before. That's fascinating. So we know from homeopaths today who have taken cases and have found the curative similimum, the curative similar remedy from the homeopathic Materia Medica, and you find when you go to look historically, maybe it has never even been listed for that particular disease. Isn't that interesting? So because the homeopath was using the art and principles of homeopathy, taking the totality of the case, taking the individual's symptoms as the prime diagnosis for the prescription, they found a remedy that helped that person. And so now what happens is that information can be a contribution to the Materia Medica. That can be a contribution to the knowledge base of homeopaths for the future, to know that that particular remedy may help another person with that particular disease. The symptoms of location, says Dr. Roberts, frequently furnish quite characteristic symptoms, and they deserve particular attention, since every remedy acts more and more decidedly on certain parts of the organism. Isn't that interesting? So that we know that particular drugs have an affinity toward different organs in the body. These differences enter into the consideration of certain local manifestations, like furunculosis, which would be like an abscess, but it also enters into those types of diseases that localize in certain parts, like gout in the great toe, and yet are of systemic origin. So here he's saying that we see the manifestation of a disease like gout, typically found in the joints, in the knee, in the big toe, but yet the disease is actually a systemic disease and is throughout the body, but we just see it localized. So we also know that certain remedies are particularly have that affinity to certain parts of the body. These symptoms all have their bearing and should be considered as to location. And they are particularly valuable to us as pertaining to localization in the right or left side of the body or of certain organs of the body. And so in the repertory which we use, we can see listings of remedies that have an affinity toward the left side of the body or the right side of the body. And that, again, helps us to narrow down our remedy selection. They are particularly valuable in noticing the location, as in the base or aspices or middle lobe of the lungs. They are particularly, so in the different organs itself, it might have even narrowly an affinity to a part of the organ. They are particularly to be noticed as to direction, on which side the trouble starts, and in which direction the symptoms move, and where they localize. As, for instance, throat troubles going from the left side to the right, or right side to the left, or continuously alternation of sides. So here again, the patient is going to tell you, well, it's this problem started on the right and went to the left side, or vice versa. We know that a remedy like glaconinum, dog's milk, has this alternation of sides. It goes left to right, right to left, back and forth. So in throat trouble specifically, So this helps, again, narrow down our selection of the remedy. And it, and we might not just have one remedy that does that. We might have a number of remedies. So a person might say the pain, we would look up in the repertory, it radiates, it spreads. It radiates from the lower part of the body to the upper part, or from the right to the left, or diagonally from the upper right to the lower left. And sometimes we'll say it stays once it localizes in, let's say, the right shoulder or the left shoulder or the right throat or the left throat. All these finer shadings have much to do with homeopathy and have very little to do with ordinary medicine. Even the nurses wonder when we ask regarding the localization of symptoms will often appear as marked symptoms before pathological changes have manifested themselves, as for instance in the beginning of the syndrome, which we call tonsillitis, or in the beginning of the similar syndrome in pneumonic conditions, where if the remedy is given an early opportunity to exhibit its power, the pathological condition will not arise. In such states, the localization and direction of symptoms become of considerable moment to the homeopathic physician. So here again, if we catch it early, if we get early symptoms and we know how to find the similimum, you can stop actual physical changes in the body, tissue and organic changes from occurring. The chief aim of the homeopathic physician consists in ascertaining the remedy that most completely and fully covers each individual case. In other words, the totality of the symptoms. And we're going to hear that repeatedly over and over in the writings. We hear so much of the totality of the symptoms that sometimes it behooves us to stop and think what this means. The homeopathic physician may be likened to an artist painting a portrait. He fills in all those features pertaining to the likeness which he is painting, and those features which may be found on all faces, ears, eyes, nose, mouth, lips. In this way, all individuals are similar, but each individual has peculiarities of his own. And in order to make the picture complete, the artist must present the individualities in the portrait, but not accentuate over and above the other features the normal position, shape, and size, as it appears in the finished picture, would be were to draw or paint only the peculiar things. In other words, he sounds like, well, let's just make a caricature or a stereotype. No, that's not what we're doing. We're not doing that. We're not exaggerating anything. We're making a normal human picture, a beautiful portrait, but we're looking very closely and observing about the facial features, about that particular individual and their peculiarities, or their individuality, better said. Just a nose or just an eye and nothing by which we could distinguish the one whom the picture was intended to represent would be just to exaggerate on one part of the being. On the other hand, if we painted the classic features only, there would be no distinguishing characteristics in the finished product. So if we just paint a beautiful picture of the ideal person, we would not be seeing that individual who is sitting before us. Welcome, guests. I appreciate listeners. And if you have comments or questions, I'll look on the chat. It is in this relationship that we must gain a knowledge of the concomitant symptoms, the things that are occurring at the same time, if we would prescribe homeopathically. In drawing the picture of the person, we must present the rare, the striking, the peculiar symptoms which present themselves, not out of keeping, but associated with the other symptoms which form a background upon which the peculiar, rare, and characteristic symptoms must be presented as determining the individuality, the personality of the man or woman for whom we are prescribing. And we call this the SRP, strange, rare, and peculiar. We're always looking for that one little thing that's going to stand out and say to us, this is this person's individuality. What sets them apart from other people in this particular type of an illness or chronic condition or acute condition. It is not the common symptoms, the common to all disease symptoms, that are of value, but the rare, the peculiar, the unusual, that stand out by themselves. It must necessarily follow that these concomitant symptoms have a wide variety and are widely distributed throughout the organism. So those strange, rare, and peculiars, you're going to notice them. They're going to be really strange. You're going to say, wow, you feel this way in this condition? I didn't think people felt that way about it. I mean, you have a sore throat, but you love to swallow food? It makes you feel better? I would think that if you were swallowing food and you had a bad sore throat, it would hurt you to swallow. So here we might have a clue about what is the individuality of the person that feels that way about something. It is almost impossible to name all the peculiarities in all the cases that we might find, but there are certain ones that stand out. First of all, those symptoms that are common and found in almost all diseases may be left out of our count unless they manifest themselves in a striking manner. So if we say a striking manner, we might say to know that this fever comes on suddenly. And so we know, like in scarlet fever or influenza or strep throat, we know the symptoms come on suddenly. That's common in all of those cases, but it is also striking that we must take that into account. The same may be true of those ailments and symptoms that usually appear in the disease under consideration, unless they should be distinguished by some rare peculiarity, and in this way offer something peculiarly characteristic, like thirstless fever or chill with desire to uncover. On the other hand, all the attendant symptoms should be carefully noted. So you can see that if you have a fever, you're hot and you want to cool off and you become dried out from this fever, that's all of your discharge through the sweat glands. And why would you be thirsty in that case? That is peculiar, is it not? Usually when you're having a fever, you might really want to drink a lot of fluids. Or what about if you're having a chill and you're trembling, and even with that chill, you don't want to cover up and warm yourself? That's really peculiar. So those are things that you want to note in your journal, in the diary and documentation. So he says, A, those symptoms which rarely appear in connection with the leading disease and therefore are found rarely among the provings. So these are things that you want to note. Those which belong to another sphere of disease than the principal ailment, and those which have more or less characteristic signs of the medicine, even though they have not before been noted in the present relationship of the diagnostic group. Let's find out what he's talking about in those three points. Dr. Roberts says, then again, besides these concomitant symptoms that have already been mentioned, there should be one in which the genius of the remedy should be plainly and definitely portrayed, that it would be immediately noticeable. This symptom would immediately attain such importance that it would outweigh the chief ailment and thus be chosen as the similimum. Such a similimum corresponds to Hahnemann's dictum. Hahnemann, who is the founder of homeopathy, says, which calls for a striking, strange, peculiar, and unusual sign, which may then be considered almost alone in choosing the remedy, because it gives preeminently the character of the whole design. So basically, it's almost like saying this is a keynote. This is so strange, rare, and peculiar. It only happens with this particular drug, with this medicine, with this homeopathic remedy, that this really defines the choice of a remedy for this case. A peculiar and unusual deduction from these concomitant symptoms is that they often illuminate remedies that have never been thought of before in this relationship to the individual case, and therefore broaden our vision and concept of the law of similars. In considering in considering what Hahnemann calls, quote, strange, rare, and peculiar characteristic symptoms, unquote, and their value in directing us to the remedy, let us remember the exposition that A. Conan Doyle, everybody knows who he is, so often puts into the mouth of his famous character, Sherlock Holmes. This worthy in summing up some famous case in which he has acted the scientific detective uses these words, quote, that which is out of the common is usually a guide rather than a hindrance, unquote. And again, he quotes, that which seemingly confuses the case is the very thing that furnishes the clue to its solution, unquote. Basically, he's saying, gee, I found something that's really weird, strange, out of place. This doesn't belong here. Why is the patient talking about this or feeling this in this particular illness? It doesn't seem right. So that's where the detective in you is going to look for some answers. Dr. Roberts says, in considering the value of symptoms in solving any chronic case, we cannot do better than to take these aphorisms for our guide and to remember that those symptoms which confuse the ordinary physician, you know, this reminds me that very often when we're gathering tons and tons of data in case studies, in research, in lab work, and you see this chart and you put the plot, the points onto the chart, onto the map, and everything is going along just as you hypothesized, and yet there's something that it belongs, that the you have to plot something in that research that's out of sync with the rest of the graph. What happens? Very often researchers say, oh, this is an anomaly. Let's just throw it out. Let's discount it. It doesn't mean anything in the research that we're doing. Yet here, Hahnemann, Sherlock Holmes, and Dr. Roberts would say, aha, what does this mean? Is this an anomaly? Is this something that's strange, rare, and peculiar? What does this point to? Does it give us a clue to an answer? Not throw us off of our hypothesis, but lead us in a direction of a better answer and a solution to the case. So this is the detective in us. So let me repeat, in considering the value of symptoms in solving any chronic case, we cannot do better than to take these aphorisms for our guide and to remember that those symptoms which confuse the ordinary physician or which he regards as useless or as having no relationship to the case are the very symptoms that furnish the clues for the remedy. That's what Dr. Roberts is telling us. In considering the value of symptoms, there are certain symptoms that are apparently caused by conditions and that almost precede the symptomatology and seem to give a basis for the patient's condition. These may be exposure to cold, exposure to wet, all those conditions of which people say that thus and so was the cause of their illness and the cause of their symptoms. These play a large part in pathological prescribing. In pathological prescribing, these causes of disease loom large. In homeopathic prescribing, they do not loom as large, save as showing the tendencies of the patient. So here we can say, you know, if the patient says, well, I was out in a cold, I was very sensitive to the wind, yes, these are the tendencies of the patient. You must take them into consideration. But unless it is something striking, rare, and peculiar, like, oh, yeah, my child went out in, it was the autumn, the weather was nice and warm, and then suddenly a cold wind blew up and the temperature dropped 10 degrees, and then they were outside without their coat, and that night they came down with a sudden fever. Okay. And they had they were frightened. Okay, we have really good clues and a reason to find causality in the temperature and the weather, because then we have remedies such as aconite, spongia, and hepersulf, the triad for croup, for getting a cold from a cold wind. This is documented, and we can use this information. But in general, things such as this nature Dr. Roberts is saying this is pathological prescribing, these causes of disease, which we determine. But in homeopathic prescribing, it's not always the case. So he goes on to say, this embraces causes that are directly traceable to diet as well as climatic conditions. Embraced in this category also are susceptibility to disease conditions and idiosyncrasies. The symptoms that are produced by trade conditions come in this category, and the poisonings that may take place from too much drugging or from working in metals, these are all good reasons to understand what is the etiology of the disease. The symptoms produced from such conditions may be valuable in showing the pathological trend of the metal or the gas or the drug causing the condition, but they do not show the finer differentiations, nor have they the same value that they do from the exhibition of the potencies. What is he talking about here? Basically, a person who is working with metals and inhaling all those fumes, they may get a drug poisoning, a metal poisoning, and be proving from the symptoms from the crude drug. And a person who is taking chronically high blood pressure medicine or another kind of medicine, what today we consider side effects, they're proving this drug in their body. How does their body handle these heavy drugs that they're taking every day? How do their organs, their liver, their kidneys, their pancreas, how do they handle these drugs that are accumulating in their body? So we might see symptoms. So he's saying, but they do not show the finer differentiations, nor have they the same value that they do from the exhibition of the potencies. So he's talking about homeopathic potencies, that you can really learn much finer details of the knowledge of a drug, of a medicine, from learning about that drug in potency and how it affects the vital force of the human being. Sometimes these early symptoms will place the physician in a position of seeing clearly the basic miasmatic condition from which the patient is himself suffering. This should bear a large place in the evaluation of symptoms. So basically, the three miasms have tendencies to express their illnesses in different body organs in different ways. Some people might want to go within themselves and be reclusive. Other people might be very expressive and want to escape from their symptoms. There's different ways that a human being can respond miasmatically. And here he's saying, well, yes, we're going to find out this information from crude drugging. This too, he says, brings up the question of infectious diseases and the symptomatology attending the so-called contagious diseases. It is the duty of the physician to take very close observation of the first cases he has in an epidemic of infectious diseases for the symptomatology. Immunity can be assured to patients if we will closely observe the symptomatology and select the epidemic remedy in the early stages of each epidemic by administering the epidemic remedy as a prophylactic. In this way, the symptomatology of epidemic diseases is exceedingly valuable to the homeopathic physician. So here, even a century ago, or the 1950s, Dr. Herbert Roberts was practicing. He did indicate that you could use homeopathic remedies in potency as preventative medicine, especially if you saw early on the movement of a contagious and epidemic disease in a population and what is the way that it responds for a majority of the people by gathering all of the symptoms that are elicited from different populations. Here he goes on to say, in analyzing the case, very valuable symptoms are those pertaining to the aggravations and ameliorations, because the aggravations and the ameliorations are the natural modifiers of disease states and are the definite reaction of the man or woman, him or herself. Basically saying, when you find out from the person, what do you need to do to make yourself feel better? what makes you feel worse? Does it hurt to touch it? Does it hurt to lie down? Do you feel better lying down? What does the disease entity force your body to do to make yourself more comfortable? These are important clues to understanding what is the disease and how does that individual respond. We must take into consideration that every symptom of note has these modifying conditions we call aggravation and amelioration. And some of the more detailed into the time of day, the time of season, the time of the moon, the aggravation or amelioration from thermic conditions, so temperature conditions, from motion or from rest, of the part affected or of the condition as a whole, from lying down or sitting or standing, and the positions taken during such conditions, waking or sleeping, and the aggravation and amelioration from such positions and circumstances. What makes the person feel better or worse? The various positions in motion that aggravate or ameliorate. For instance, we know worse from a jar. What does that mean? Worse from a jar. We could look that up in the repertory and find a number of remedies for that. The desire or aversions to eating and drinking. Is there a loss of appetite? Is there satiation from drinking, from eating? Do you feel better immediately? Or an hour later, you feel worse again? All of these bits of information are important to tell us the desires and aversions, the ameliorations and aggravations, especially in feverish conditions, aggravations from certain foods and drink. These are all modifications that are of the utmost importance in evaluating the symptoms. And when we think about it, would your regular physician ever ask you this information? And if they got this information, what would they do with it? Let's say you said to them, I really crave lemonade, or I really must have a soda, or I really have to have a drink of coffee, or I need some hot soup. What is a regular physician going to do with this information? Not really much, because they don't understand that it is the innate person, their survival method, talking to you and giving you these clues. While we cannot hope to cure a patient without strong general symptoms, yet conditions of aggravation or amelioration may in themselves become generals if they appertain in the same way to several parts of the body. They then become conditions of the man as a whole, or general symptoms, even though they seemingly express themselves in local parts. Here, Dr. Roberts gives us an example. For instance, if a headache is worse by motion, if the pain in the knee is worse by walking or stepping, if there is pain in the shoulder from raising the arm, then the worse then from motion becomes a general, as of the whole man, although it seemingly appears in disassociated parts. So here he's talking about an individual that has a headache, it's worse by motion, pain in the knee is worse by motion, which they might say it's worse stepping or walking. If there's pain in the shoulder from raising the arm, we can see that the theme here is worse from motion. That becomes what we call a general, which is he emphasizes is most important to understand about the whole picture of the person, even though it's the same theme is occurring in different parts of the body. The contradictory symptoms have an importance because they may rule out many of the remedies that otherwise might be considered in connection with an individual case. That is, symptoms that are decidedly opposed to the proving, like the thirstlessness of the fever using the remedy Ignatia or Apis or Pulsatilla, when fever is present and when other symptoms agree. Contradictory symptoms may have a strong bearing in choosing the remedy from the standpoint of being themselves a symptom, just as a paucity of symptoms may be a symptom in itself, as has been brought out in the provings of the so-called do-nothing remedies, which are often called for in profound states. For this reason, if you cannot find a remedy because of alternating or contradictory symptoms or for lack of symptoms, take these conditions as indications for symptoms of the very first rank. Quite interesting. So he's saying it doesn't seem to make any sense. The symptoms that the patient is eliciting don't fit into the picture very well. They're contradictory symptoms. And so when that happens, that's like Sherlock Holmes. That's giving you something that's out of the ordinary. We need to take this into account, that with the thirstlessness of the fever, what is this telling us? That this is quite unusual, and what remedies have this particular symptom? To emphasize again the necessity for consideration of the aggravations and ameliorations of the periods of distress. So when the person is at their worst, their most discomfort, we need to look at what it is that are making them feel better or worse. It is well to bear in mind the period of onset in periodic manifestations of symptoms. The increase, the acme, the decrease, and the end of the disease manifestations in the evaluation of symptoms. For instance, conditions such as Cedron, Spigelia, Sanguinaria, and Nitrum Muriaticum, four homeopathic remedies used seemingly for headache, these remedies have a decided periodicity. And it is very important to consider also those symptoms that occur in the recession or in the intervals between the periods of aggravation. So these remedies that he called upon, Cedron, Spigelia, Sanguinaria, and Nitrum Muriaticum, have different ways that they express themselves in time, in a period in time. When does the person feel worse? So you need to take this information when you ask them, when do you feel worse or when do you feel better? How does that disease progress over a 24-hour period, over a monthly cycle, over the time of the moon? This can give you some information. These are but a few of the conditions confronting the homeopathic physician if he would cure his patients. And he should learn early to evaluate symptoms, because symptoms are the sole expression of the internal disturbance. And it is only by the proper understanding of these expressions in disease and an equal knowledge of the condition as expressed in the provings, the clinical trials of homeopathic remedies, that we can apply our guiding law, which is similia similibus curantur, intelligently and for the benefit of our patients. So he always, at the end of each chapter, gives us some refresher, reminder of what we have been learning and discussing, and to set that into our memory banks, he asks us, what symptoms rank the highest in an analysis of the case? And so if you go back to the beginning of the chapter, which is chapter 9 of analysis of the case, we need to understand definitely the generals, and we need to understand the mental and emotional characteristics, which are of high value. And we also must understand the disease progression itself, have knowledge about the disease. How do we rate generals, he asks, mentals, emotional symptoms, subjective symptoms, objective symptoms, and concomitant symptoms, those that occur at the same time? Obviously, we know from the reading that generals rank very highly because they indicate the whole person. And the objective symptoms we must take into account as well. Concomitants can give us striking and rare and peculiar, wouldn't they? Where do we place much emphasis on objective symptoms and why? That's a question he asks. Objective symptoms are less differentiate. In other words, the diagnostic testing that we get in the lab, those objective symptoms, they can just give us some general information, but peculiar to the case, not really. Cite an instance where an objective symptom may be translated as a subjective symptom. I think he told us that could occur when we look at the child or look at the adult. When we're taking the case of someone who says it's because of the weather, it's because of a drug that I took, that might be subjective. That might be objective symptom. Yes, it seems like it's a cause, but it can be translated into a subjective symptom. How much consideration should we place on the diagnosis of the case? What do you think? I'll let you answer that. Give an outline of the totality of a case. That's a big question. The totality of the case, what is that? When may common symptoms attain a peculiar value? So things that are common to all people who have a particular disease, when would it become a peculiar value, a striking, rare, and peculiar, and very much important, like Sherlock Holmes? That would be in a contagious disease, in an epidemic, when you've gathered all of the common diseases from all the population and say, this defines this disease in this period in time. And then it helps you to recognize the disease. What do we mean by epidemic remedy? And how can we determine the epidemic remedy? When may a particular symptom become a general? That's his final question. When may a particular symptom become a general? And do you have the answer in your mind? He gave an example just at the end of this talk today that when you see, for instance, the headache is worse by motion, the pain in the knee is worse by walking or stepping, if there's pain in the shoulder from raising the arm, that becomes a general, that becomes worse from motion. When you see that and you are able to interpret all of those different subjective symptoms that the patient elicits and say this overriding symptom for the whole person becomes a general. And this is the end of Chapter 9, The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy. I really appreciate that we have listeners today, that you're interested in learning about homeopathy, refreshing your knowledge, reviewing, repeating old information that you've learned before. I welcome you to join us on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio every Wednesday morning at 10:30 Eastern Time. That I'm not exactly sure what time that is in New Delhi, India. It's probably about 9 p.m. or 9:30 p.m. in the evening there. And we have Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim. He has been our marvelous guru, master homeopath, fourth generation homeopath, teaching us about his life experience, real life case studies, what he's learned from other homeopaths and his lectures. He's been talking this past Wednesday about masses in breast tissue, homeopathic remedies related to that, diagnostics, understanding our anatomy, just about the progression of disease. And I welcome you to send him a message or send me a message if you have a question. We will answer your questions on air if you have a comment. He has got so many questions from every point on the globe listening in to his show. On Thursday at noon Eastern Time, we have Alan Phillips, our legal attorney, talking about exemptions and waivers with vaccinations, and we talk about current events, what's going on in your neighborhood and around the globe. On Monday, we have the Health In Show with special guests in being interviewed. Last week, we talked with Sergei Butenko, who was a young child of age 9 who diagnosed with juvenile diabetes, and he didn't want to go the route of insulin injections, and they investigated a vegetarian raw diet. This young man, now his birthday was just the 28th yesterday of November, he turned 28, a special turning point in his life, 28 on the 28th of November. He is diabetes free through all of these years of his good diet and, most importantly, exercise regime, exercise regimen that he has been very strictly held to. And thus, if you imagine that juvenile diabetes, which you consider a functional disease, a hereditary autoimmune disease, can be cured, then what can we do with diabetes 2, when adult onset diabetes. Can we cure ourselves through our diet, through our nutrition, through good lifestyle and exercise? Ask yourself that. And our 2 hours of talking today is over. We're going to finish the show. I highly recommend that you get on, just look over the articles at Homeopathy World Community. Take a look at Miranda Castro's page. She has a discount code to her cell salts and remedies. Homeopathy World, Mary Aspinwall, has remedy kits that you could easily have at your disposal, in your home, in your car. The Complete Dynamics homeopathic computer program is the one that I use. And you click on the Complete Dynamics link on the front page of, or on any page of Homeopathy World Community, and learn a little bit more about that. If you're a physician, if you're a homeopath, you probably would like to have this program on your desktop. We also have Homeopathy for Farm and Garden by Kavir Raj, and lots of resources. So I want to thank you so much for listening to our show, sharing it, tweeting it, Facebooking, and get reminders to listen to all of our shows. I'm going to end the show today, and I want to thank you so much for hanging in there with me for 2 hours. If you've missed the show, go back and listen to the archives. Take care. Sending waves of awareness and lots of love out into the universe.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. Your truth be unheard.